All right, welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I'm Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is off doing sun stuff. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. That's radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. All right, so it's an exciting day. It's the day after the election, and I'm feeling somewhat hopeful. We did have a lot of blue stuff happening in this state, and it does look like we're going to get a new governor, and that governor is going to be Ned Lamont. Bob Stefanowski has already conceded, and it was a very narrow margin, which means that the state was pretty closely divided on how they felt about blue versus red, Democrat versus Republican, and what sort of job Ned Lamont could do versus Bob Stefanowski. So it's really interesting that Mr. Lamont won, and we'll see how he does. I feel bad for those people who feel like, well, they're tired of Daniel Malloy and his policies, and that Ned Lamont is more of the same. It's like a third term of Ned Lamont, Daniel Malloy. But we'll see how it goes. Ned Lamont seems like he's a good guy and he wants to do right by Connecticut. He doesn't seem like he's in it for political power. We'll see who else gets elected. It's really interesting. Also, what's interesting is that the House of Representatives, the Federal House of Representatives, is overwhelmingly Democratic now, which gives a balance to the fact that the Senate is overwhelmingly Republican. So we'll see if we have a little more balance as to whose ideas and needs get put forward, and if there can be some reaching across the aisle and people getting together and figuring out what we need to do together to make this country a better place and to make sure that people just get what they, get what they're looking for and have a voice and have respect and respect for this country. We certainly need some more of that and some more respectful activity and behaviors on the part of our legislators. So let's see if that can happen. Election day, I had fun yesterday. So if you look at Strava, Strava offered to give you a badge if you ran to the polls or if you rode your bike to the polls. It couldn't tell if you were riding your bike to the polls or running to the polls. So basically, if you rode your bike or ran, you got a badge. I, in fact, did ride my bike from my house to the pole, which was a less than 3 mile bike ride, which was just fine. It was very exciting. I wore a vote sign on my back as I was riding my bike, although I had in a little ditty bag on my back, I had my sneakers in there so that I could do a run from the polls, because I like to, at this time of year, I'm, you know, preparing for the Manchester Road Race. So I did an out and back, and I wore a vote sign on my back, and I gave peace, what looked like a peace sign was really a V, and I was mouthing vote to all the cars that went by me. So it was sort of fun. As I was passing the Southeast School, a nice woman stopped me, and she said, "Oh, I have to take your picture." So she did, and then I subsequently saw her at the poll. So after I was done with my run, I went in, and I, in fact, voted. So it was a very exciting time. I hung out with our local state representative, Greg Haddad, and that was nice. So I got to say hello to him and got selfies with him, and we posted them. So we got, you know, a lot of excitement going on there. The PTO from the Southeast School was there, and they were selling goodies, and that was fun. So it was a fun, vibrant time. The other thing was to see so many people coming out. So where I live, I vote at the Buchanan Auditorium, which is part of the Mansfield Library. And the parking lot was just blocked. It was just full of cars, people coming and going, a lot of excitement, a lot of people there. Ron, who is not here today, he is the moderator for the Annie Vinton School for that district. And he texted me and said it was a zoo over there. So exciting. It was so exciting to see so many people voting. Ron said that the usually they get a 25% turnout for midterm elections. And this year they got a 72% turnout for the midterm election. It's so exciting. So many people were mobilized and excited from both sides. Everybody's excited. So everybody's vote really counted. It was just a really exciting time. It, it was a good day. And there's hope. And not so much that I want to see the Democrats win as much as I'd like to see some balance, that there's some really scary things being said by the so-called Republicans. And I don't think it's the true Republican Party. I think the Republican Party really has a set of ideals about how they run government that's different from the Democratic Party. And that's just fine. The Republican Party wants less government control and more agency on the part of the individual constituent, and on more agency on the part of each person, whereas the Democracy wants more oversight by government and more care. I mean, those are just basic principles. Fiscally, there's some different ideas. And sometimes ideas on either side can appeal to opposite sides. And it's a difference in philosophy. It's kind of like, you're Christian, I'm Jewish. Let's have a party. Let's go to services together and learn from each other. That's really how it should be. This situation of how our president says that the Democrats are really bad, evil people, that has really got to go away. I really don't want to be thinking bad thoughts about my Republican friends and neighbors and country people. I really would like to see reaching across the aisle and just an understanding that we're all Americans and we all want similar things, and that let's talk about how everybody can get what they want and, have discussions, because we're not going to want the same things. Like being in a relationship, two people in a relationship are not necessarily going to want the same things. And one of the things that you do when you're in a relationship is you figure out ways to make everybody happy, and you sit down and discuss it intelligently. The situation of us versus them, this, schoolyard bully mentality, Republicans are so much better than Democrats, that Democrats are bad, evil people, and they have terrible policies, and all of the race baiting and the misogyny and, transphobia and LGBTQ phobia and all of that has got to go away. We did have some wonderful things happen. We had our first Native American Congress people elected. We had our first Muslim American Congress people elected. We had a lot of women elected. I don't know what the latest on Stacey Abrams is, if anybody knows. Actually, I'm going to throw that in. Stacey Abrams, because the last I heard that election between Abrams and Kemp was very close. And so, yeah, I don't know how that's going. No, it looks like right now, Stacey Abrams was not conceded yet as of, 7 hours ago. She 4 hours ago, she's still not conceded. And the stats that I see in front of me say that, there's 50% votes for Kemp and 48.6 for Abrams. So it's very, very close. It's very exciting. And I heard Stacey Abrams speak. I was very, very impressed with her. So let's see. Well, it'll be very interesting to see how that goes either way. So it's very exciting time. It's very hopeful. I think there will be more balance. What I'm really hoping for is more balance in the sense of this baiting and shaming and bullying. Let's have that go away. And despite what, the bully in chief does, can we have that go away so that Republicans and Democrats and all people can talk to each other and truly make this country great, and reach out to each other and have togetherness? Maybe that's the one of the gifts that the baby in chief will give us, is that this is something we don't want. Not that we don't want Republicans or Republican ideals, that we don't want shaming and a president that we have to be ashamed of. And that that he can behave in a civil manner and make us proud to be seen around the world. And if he can't do that for us, then we have to do it for him. We have to rise above that in spite of him. People on both sides. So let's see if we can make that happen. I'm hopeful. It's an exciting day. It was raining like crazy yesterday. When I went out, it was drizzling, and I rode on my bike even though it was drizzly out. And then later in the day, it started to pour. People went out and voted anyway. I'm so happy and I'm so proud of them. So, all right. So let's talk about some natural medicine stuff. And I went to the New Hampshire Association of Naturopathic Doctors convention, and I haven't had a chance to sort through everything that I looked at, that I learned at that conference, because there was so much. But I'll give you a few highlights, and then we'll talk about some other things. All right. So the first speaker that I'll paraphrase would be Robin DePasquale, and apparently people at Bastyr had her as a they had her for her for herbal, their herbal professor, and so she was there. Jill Stansberry to me. So Jill Stansberry was my teacher, and she's somebody I really love and taught me a lot about herbs. And she's also still very active in teaching and traveling and doing research. And sometimes she does lecture, but we didn't see her there this time. So we had Robin DePasquale. It was very interesting. So she talked about menopause and talked about things like 70% of us get hot flashes, then that stat seems not to have changed over the years, because that's what they told us back in the 90s, that about 70% of women, no matter what you do, they get hot flashes. And I don't know if that's no matter what you do, because given the conditions that we live in, you know, the conditions of stress and sometimes questionable nutrition and, you know, the chemical exposures and all the things that we're exposed to, in this situation, 75% of Western women get hot flashes, which means that 25% don't. And of those 25%, are they all doing really healthy things, or is it just a genetic thing? Some women just seem not to have their hypothalamuses affected so much by hot flashes. So hot flashes, the way that they pretty much happen, as I understand, is that hot flashes are a symptom of low estrogen. And the deal is that there are estrogen receptors on your hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is an organ in your brain that does many things. It is the hypermaster gland of the endocrine system, that system that has lots of glands throughout your body that put hormones directly into your blood. So it oversees all of that. It also is responsible for temperature regulation. And there are estrogen receptors on the hypothalamus. And so when you have low estrogen, the hypothalamus doesn't get its estrogen. The estrogen doesn't bond. And one thing that estrogen bonding has to do with is temperature regulation. So when the estrogen doesn't bond, the hypothalamus thinks you're cold. And so it goes to heat you up. It thinks you're cold, or it thinks you're hot. And it goes, I guess that's not right. It thinks you're hot. So it goes to heat you up and make you sweat so that you will cool down. And the hypothalamus is confused because it's not getting its estrogen. And so when you have that lack of bonding of estrogen, the hypothalamus decides, you know what, we got to heat you up. So we're going to make you hot, and we're going to make you sweat. And as soon as you sweat, you're going to cool down. And so what women often experience is they get these flashes. They are what we call vasomotor events. They involve blood vessels and the motion of the musculature of the blood vessels. This event is spurred on by other things, but the main thing that's spurring it on is the lack of estrogen. You don't see hot flashes in a woman who's estrogen dominant or a woman who's taking estrogen. It's really a function of low estrogen. If you're getting hot flashes, your estrogen is low. Your body doesn't like. It's just it's evidence that you have estrogen too low to make your hypothalamus happy. So your body generally thinks that you're hot and it has to cool you down. And so it makes you even hotter, makes you sweat, and then you cool off, and then a lot of women feel cold afterwards. Women vary in when they get their hot flashes. They may get them during the day. They may get them at night. I know for me personally, I'm still getting them. I've been without my moon now for 3 years, and I'm still getting them. And I think when you're younger, you know, my mother says that she doesn't get them anymore. That's just not something that happens to her anymore. And she's, you know, without her menses for a good 23 years. I'm 3 years out, and I'm still getting them. And I find that they are hastened by stress, that if I get excited, so I have opportunities to be stressed. And the classic thing that makes me, and I'm being stressed in the moment, and it doesn't mean that I'm upset stressed, although it could, but the common everyday stress I experience is if I'm talking to you right now. Talking to you right now is not as stressful for me as getting excited and talking to a patient. When I'm talking to a patient, of course, there's a lot more going on. When I'm talking to you, I'm just sort of thinking about what to say. I'm not directly responsible for a person in front of me. So the words just get to come out of my mouth and, you know, I just get to talk about stuff. I'm still in a heightened state. But when I'm with a patient, there's so many things going on. I'm talking with the patient. I'm absorbing what the patient is saying. I'm observing the patient nonverbally as I am talking with them. I'm also in my head figuring out how to help them and the next thing that I'm going to say and the different things that could be helpful to them. And I'm also having to take chart notes. So there's a lot of thinking and planning. A lot of things are going on when I'm interacting with a patient, and that can put me in a really heightened state. And that can lead to a hot flash. Also, there's other things that lead to hot flashes. A warm room. If it's too warm in the room, if you're hot, you're more likely to have a hot flash. Surprise, surprise. So if you eat hot food, if you do things that cause vasodilation in your skin in the first place, like drink alcohol or eat spicy food, if you do things that increase circulation to your liver, so for example, drinking alcohol is another thing like that. If you eat a big meal, that's going to increase circulation to your whole digestive system. If it goes to your liver more, you're going to be more likely to have a hot flash. Also, if you eat sugar. There's a lot of women who tell me that when they eat sweets, they're more likely to get hot flashes. And if you eat sweets at the end of the night, you're more likely to get a night sweat. And if you avoid sweets, you're less likely to get them, which is very interesting. Also, I think if you eat too close to bed, you're more likely to get hot flashes because if you eat too close to bed, you're going to be too warm when you sleep because your body is busy working on all that food. And your enterohepatic circulation, the circulation between your digestive system and your liver, is going to be heightened, and that's going to make you hot. In Chinese medicine, the liver has a lot of fire. And if you eat too much before you go to sleep, you're going to have liver fire rising, even if it's not to the point where you get heartburn, just energetically. You're not supposed to be laying down with all that food in your stomach. So things tend to rise and where they shouldn't, and you get more heat. So you're more likely to get that happen. So one of the things about menopause, so a hot flash is kind of a sentinel. It is a barometer. You know, there it is. It's a hot flash, but it's kind of a barometer, which is really about pressure. But it's a barometer of how you're managing your menopause. So if you're getting hot flashes, you're probably, it's a kind of a sign that you're not able to manage your menopause in the way that nature wants you to. And don't feel bad about that. It is the nature of 21st century North America that if you're a woman who has a lot of stuff to do, you know, when do you get your menopause? You get your menopause usually somewhere between age 40 and 55. Unless you are independently wealthy, which we know that most of us are not, about, you know, 99% of us are not. That and you don't have control of how much rest you get, that you you know, that you have, you're a very busy person, chances are you're not going to be doing all the things that keep hot flashes down, like getting enough sleep, getting to bed on time, getting your exercise, being very mindful about all of the things you're eating, avoiding all of your sugar, really managing your alcohol consumption. I know that when I'm stressed and I don't have time to myself, and I don't get downtime, like I don't get time to sit down and read a book and have a cup of tea somewhere during the day or get a nap in, I'm more likely at the end of the day to want to eat dessert because that's my pleasure. I didn't get to rest when I wanted to rest, so I want to treat myself, so I'm more likely to have sugar. I might not necessarily have like a huge bowl of ice cream, but you know, I might have a little piece of chocolate and I might have, you know, a few bites of ice cream. And a little bit of pastry, but, you know, and keeping it within a couple hundred calories. Still, that's enough to make me have a hot flash in the middle of the night. So, and then just the plain old stress. If your cortisol rises up, you're not going to be able to experience the estrogen that you still do make in your body. And you still do make estrogen when you're in menopause. I tested a woman who's in menopause just the other day, and I tested her hormones. She's definitely, not only is she past menopause, but she's without a uterus. And I tested her estrogen, and she had some. She didn't have any progesterone, but she had some estrogen. And she definitely has menopausal symptoms. So you still can make it. You make it from your adrenals, you make it from your ovaries, and you manufacture it in your fat cells. So, but sometimes it's not enough to keep you out of hot flashes, or usually it's not enough to keep you out of hot flashes, because 75% of us get them. So what Robin brought up is that menopause is a time to pause. That's why it's called pause, that you want to do less stuff. You want to reduce your stress, spend time in quiet contemplation. She talked about liking chanting. There's a kind of Sanskrit kind of chanting called kirtan that she likes to participate in. We talked about the different homeopathic remedies that can be helpful for menopause. And interestingly, a lot of them were remedies from animals that can attack you. So homeopathic lachecis, which is, it's a snake that's very aggressive. Crotalus horridus is another snake. Sepia is the cuttlefish that when you upset the cuttlefish, it sprays you with ink. And sepia is a very classic homeopathic remedy. It's what we call a polycrest. It's a homeopathic remedy that's used very frequently for many things in natural medicine. Homeopathic tarantula, it's a spider. Then some things that are not actually, you know, dangerous things. Ignatia and homeopathic ignatia, of course, is a classic grief remedy. It happens to be a poisonous nut that you make a remedy out of that you would never take in material doses. But as a homeopathic remedy, it's great. Natrum muriaticum is a great menopause remedy because natrum muriaticum people tend to get hot. And it's just salt, it's homeopathic salt. And chocolate. Chocolate is something that many of us crave, and homeopathic chocolate can be helpful for helping with menopause. Staphylococcus aegria was an interesting homeopathic remedy. It's a pretty little flower. But this pretty little flower, when it gets upset, it holds back its anger, and when it gets angry, it throws things. So that's interesting. Homeopathic zinc is another one. Interesting thing about zinc. Zinc has a lot of neurological stuff because it's a metal. And homeopathic zinc, you can get tremors, and it can be a remedy for seizures, and it's a remedy for being cranky. So very interesting. You can also get a lot of cardiovascular symptoms that maybe you didn't have when you were younger. So you can have issues both with cardiovascular disease and issues with heart rhythm. So this is something that Robin brought up that I found really interesting, is that some cardiologists are plumbers and some cardiologists are electrophysiologists. I didn't think about that. That's very interesting. So if you are a plumber, then you're going to be more likely to deal with people who have atherosclerosis, that is hardening of the arteries, blockages of the arteries that are leading to the brain or that are leading to the heart. And so you're going to be looking at people's cholesterol. You're going to be doing, stress EKGs and echocardiograms to make sure that the works are open up, that there's good flow and that you have good blood flow, and that you're going to be helping people to have their blood vessels be open. Whereas an electrophysiologist is going to be somebody who is worried about the rhythm. So if you get your atrial fibrillation, or if you get your premature ventricular contractions or atrial flutter, or if you ultimately have need to have a cardiac ablation or cardiac inversion, they're going to be the ones to help you with that. And they'll help you with those electrophysiological procedures, and they would also help you with medicine for that. So I hadn't thought about that. A big one here, and I forgot to order some of this, is that there is a branch of natural medicine called gemotherapy. And Robin DePasquale is very interested in gemotherapy. And when I was in Newfoundland, I was working with Dr. Gordon Higgins, who was a student of Michael Adams. And Michael Adams, I'm not sure if he's still working with the Sir Royal Company, Genestra. And Dick Tom, who also spoke at the conference, is a student of Michael Adams as well. they work with a particular company, and then Robin works with another company, but they both use these compounds called gemotherapies. Gemotherapies are very nice. First of all, they tend to taste pretty good. And their remedies, they're very interesting because they are herbs that are extracted, and they are parts of the herbs, the parts of the plant that are in very early stages of development. So you know how we talk about white tea, that white tea is the same plant as black tea and green tea. They're all the same plant. But white tea is, you pick the tea leaves at the time before the leaves are unfurled. So plants, when they are sprouting, when they are rootlets, when they are buds, they have nutrients in them that they have at no other time in their development. So they're very special. So ostensibly, they can help you with those cofactors and nutrients that can help with regrowth and regeneration. So it's very nice. So when you make a gemotherapy, that's what you're doing. Depending on the plant, you might be using rootlets, root bark. You might be using buds. You might be using sprouts. Those are the different kinds of things that you use. So the gemotherapies can be very powerful. And the gemotherapies tend to be extracted. They make a mother tincture out of it. And then they are also shaken and imbued with frequency. So they're partially homeopathic and partially herbal. So they're really neat like that. And she said Vaccinium Vitis Ideus was a primary one for menopause. And she referred to it as cowberry. So I'm not sure where Vaccinium Vitis Ideus is called cowberry. Obviously, it's called different things in different places. So Vaccinium Vitis Ideus is one of my favorite plants. It in Newfoundland, it's called the partridge berry. And I told her that. And that's kind of interesting. Newfoundland's called partridge berry in... and she said, oh, but partridge berry is something else. And that's true that Michella repens is also known as partridge berry. I think it's partridge berry. There's other plants that are known as partridge berry, but Newfoundland partridge berry is Vaccinium Vitis Ideus. And Newfoundland, partridge berry is, it grows very nicely and it's in abundance and people pick it, and it is like a slightly less sour cranberry, and it doesn't necessarily have to grow in a bog. But people pick them and they make jam out of them. If you go to Newfoundland, it's very easy to find partridge berry jam when the partridge berries are out. Tim Hortons has partridge berry muffins for you, and other people will make partridge berry muffins. You can make partridge berry sauce, and people just use a lot of partridge berry stuff, and it's really quite lovely. If you go to the Newfie store in Boston, you can get your partridge berry jam there too, and it's very tasty. I believe it is also known as lingonberry, so it's popular. Lingonberry is popular in, I believe, Scandinavia, and it's the same plant, Vaccinium Vitis Ideus. It's just called different things, different places. It's the foxberry. I believe it's called the foxberry in Nova Scotia. So very nice plant. And the gemotherapy apparently can be very helpful for menopausal symptoms. And I'm going to try it and I'll get back to you. She also suggested a couple of other gemotherapies, two very nice plants, rosemary and dogwood. So if you can get your hands on gemotherapies, the nice thing about them is you don't have to take a lot of them. You take a few drops. They generally taste good, especially, you know, if it's made from partridge berry, it's going to taste good. So they come in liquids. They're very nice. And so she also likes doing sarcoids from the pituitary and thyroid gland. Sarcodes. Those are homeopathic remedies made from organs. Those can be helpful as well. And then, of course, liver tonics, turmeric, artichoke, rosemary, the Chinese herb Free and Easy Wanderer can be helpful. And rosemary is a great liver and gallbladder tonic. I should just eat more rosemary. It's so good. It's really good on your fish. It's really good on your chicken. It's really good in your rice. It's just really good. It's really delicious on potatoes. I'm going to get some more rosemary. We're going to start eating more rosemary. There's some other herbs. She talked about some Chinese herbs. Angelica is a balancer really for everyone. Angelica meaning dong quai. Dong quai is a Chinese herb that I don't tend to use it enough. And Angelica, dong quai, it's like another ginseng. It's a great adaptogen for men and women, but it is a great women's adaptogen. So is peony and licorice. Then there's this herb Blue Plurum, which is used a lot in Chinese medicine. I like to use blue blueprim, compounds with blueprim in them, blueprim, because it's a liver tonic as well as an estrogenic tonic. So it can be really helpful for menopause. She has an opinion about chemical antidepressants that they slow people from being fully present. Obviously, that's true. Some people find that they have to take them and they really do make their lives better. But gosh, if there's any way that you can use natural medicine to avoid taking an antidepressant, I agree with her. And yet, if somebody comes in and they're on an antidepressant and they're doing really well on it, I'm not going to tell them to stop taking it. And if somebody's so depressed and they've tried everything and they want to try a chemical pharmaceutical, I am not going to stop them. The antidepressants, you know, the SSRIs, as far as drugs go, they do have side effects. And some of the side effects are merely annoying, like they can cause weight gain. And they also, in terms of what they do to mood, they tend to level out your mood. So you're not so sad anymore, but you're also not so happy. You don't really enjoy stuff like you used to. So if there's any way that we can help you to not have to take those, that's a good idea. She talked about how Tirone Lodog, who works with her in her company and works with Emerson Ecologics. Tirone Lodog was somebody I took class with when I was in naturopathic college, and I'm so thrilled that she's still around and she's still lecturing, and she's a brilliant lecturer. If you ever get to hear her lecture, she's really amazing. And what she became an MD as well, and she suggests that if you're going to use bioidentical hormone replacement, that you should use your estrogen topically and your progesterone orally. That's interesting. I think that's an interesting concept. I like the idea of using the estrogen topically because estrogen is something that you don't want interacting with your liver, and it's going to interact with your liver less if you use it topically. Because it can overload your liver and you can get estrogen dominance and you can get too many metabolites. So when you use it topically, you can use a lower dose and you avoid that first liver pass and you avoid having to use larger doses. So if you can apply the estrogen topically to skin or to the vulva and you get good results that way. So the thing is, too, if people are just struggling with hot flashes, I will consider... I'll talk to them about doing bioidentical hormones because how uncomfortable can you be? She also suggests that if you're going to do estrogen, you want to do your progesterone orally. And that is my preference as well. But when you do progesterone orally, you don't swallow a pill. I'm not as concerned about the first liver pass if you're doing oral micronized progesterone where you're swallowing a pill. However, I like to do the sublingual, sublingual oral progesterone. So that way you're not, again, you have the situation where you can take a lower dose, you put it in your mouth, you keep it under your tongue, and it enters your body through the circulation under your tongue as opposed to you having to swallow it. And when I take my progesterone, that is what I do. I have not gone to the other side and taken estrogen yet. I don't know if I'm going to try not to do that. I have patients who their hot flashes are so bad that they're constant. They're all day. They're all night. They can't sleep. I definitely get them at night, but mine seem to be manageable, especially when I'm able to relax. So I'm going to try not to do that. I do like taking oral progesterone, and I do like taking some topical testosterone. And women don't have sex drive issues. Both DHEA and testosterone can be helpful for those. She has found that when women get put on gabapentin, gabapentin is a drug that you often get put on for nerve pain. She finds that it's very difficult to get people off them, and there are great things that you can use otherwise. If there's ways that we can help you to not have to take gabapentin, that would be great. So women who get gas and bloating and digestive upset, she really likes walnut gemotherapy. So that's really interesting. If you've tried a lot of different things for your gas and bloating, I had a patient who had that just recently, and I forgot to tell her about that, walnut gemotherapy can be really helpful for that. So thanks to Dr. DePasquale for all of that interesting information. Okay. Then we had Dr. Tom, Dick Tom, who's a naturopathic physician. And before he was a naturopathic physician, he was a dentist. And he's been lecturing for forever. Because when I was in naturopathic school in from 1991 to 1995 at the National College of Naturopathic Medicine, which is now the National University of Natural Medicine, because there are several colleges and several degrees that you can get, so it's not just a naturopathic school. And so he was lecturing there then in 1991 when I was there. And so that's already a long time ago. How long ago was that? So let me see, 2021 will be 30 years. So we're 3 years shy. So 27 years ago, Dr. Tom was lecturing there and he lectured me this weekend. He's still at it. My goodness. All right. And so he used to be a dentist. So he gave us some interesting information about dental stuff. All right. So have you ever heard of Weston Price? Weston Price was this dentist in, I believe, the 1920s, and he studied other cultures, and he found that people who lived in other cultures who didn't eat sugar and didn't eat modern foods and basically ate a hunter-gatherer style diet had perfect teeth. How interesting is that? They didn't brush their teeth. They didn't do anything special. They had perfect, lovely white teeth that were straight. They didn't have malocclusions. They didn't have crowding. They didn't have anything anything wrong with them. Really interesting. And then when these cultures eventually got to eat modern food, like, you know, the Maoris, or when tribal people start moving to the cities and they start eating processed food, then they start getting their tooth decay and their malocclusion and stuff like that. And he really feels that we naturopathic physicians should be asking dental questions to our patients. And I'm a big believer in that. I really love my dentist. I was at the dentist today. Unfortunately, I had a few little rough spots in my mouth that had to be filled today. But, you know, I have a really great hygienist. Shout out to Kim O'Keefe. And that I learn a lot about dental hygiene and all of the different things. And then when I come upon things that have been researched, I interact with my dentist that way. So I talked to both Dr. Shvarek and to Kim about the different things you can do for your teeth. So I didn't get to talk about that today because I was more concerned about the fact that I have jury duty next week. So I may or may not be here next week because I've been called for jury duty. Okay. And so your dental health can really impact your entire health. Here's why. If you have cavities, there's bacteria that's growing in the cavities. If you have a root canal that's smoldering, you can get bacteria in your whole body. If you have periodontal disease, meaning that you have inflamed gums, you have inflamed gums because there's bacteria growing between your gum and your teeth. That can cause more tooth decay. It causes the tooth to not stay in place. And also that bacteria, you have, remember how I just said that it's good to take oral progesterone because it goes in the mucous membranes in your mouth and you can absorb stuff there? Well, guess what? You got blood vessels all over your mouth. And if you have bacteria there, it can get into your bloodstream. And then what can happen to it? Well, if it gets in your bloodstream, the scariest thing it can do is set up on your heart valves and give you endocarditis. How crazy is that? So you can get, and there's other thoughts that part of why people get cardiovascular disease is poor oral health, that the bacteria, you actually get rests of bacteria in your coronary arteries and perhaps in your cerebrovascular system. And they set up and they cause inflammation and they cause your body to make plaques. So flossing and picking your teeth is a way to prevent cardiovascular disease. You heard it here. I mean, I heard it there, but now you're hearing it here. So while you're listening to this, if you're home, please floss. Maybe go and get some dental floss and keep listening, or maybe get a dental pick. Toothpicks are okay too. My hygienist has me both floss and pick, and I was just flossing, and she wasn't satisfied with the condition of my gums, so she's like, here, take this dental pick, and it took me a couple of years to agree to use it, but I started using it, and whoa, what a difference. She's very pleased. She said that my periodontal condition is much better now. Also, this is interesting. You know how everybody wants white teeth and you take the tissue test, and if your tissue test, you fail the tissue test because your teeth look yellow next to the tissue. That's a vanity thing. What color is enamel? Anybody? Anybody? Bueller? Enamel is not white. Enamel is clear. So if your enamel is stained, then you're going to see stuff on the enamel. But healthy enamel is actually clear. The mineral layer that builds up over your dentin is clear. And if your teeth are whiter, you have more enamel wear. Who knew that? So if you have your teeth are too white, you may want to do stuff to re-enamel, to add to the enamel on your teeth. Your teeth should be slightly yellow because that's the color of the dentin underneath the enamel. Enamel is susceptible to demineralization and it can be replaced. 90% of adults have some enamel wear and tooth decay. And tooth decay is the most common chronic disease. A cavity is an infection. The enamel is affected and can affect the dentin as well. And the main cause is fermentable carbohydrates. That when you eat sugar, you get this bacteria in your mouth, strep mutans, and it ferments the sugars and it makes stuff called plaque. The plaque is acidic. And when you have acidic plaque in there, it eats at your enamel. Plaque forms within 24 hours to make enough to make tooth decay. So if you get rid of your plaque, if you disrupt the plaque every 24 hours, you should be much further on your way to preventing tooth decay. And so he thinks that disrupting your, brushing your teeth and flossing and doing all that stuff once a day should be enough. There are cell salts you can use to help to prevent and treat cavities. Things like calc fos, calc fluor, even calc carb, which is not a cell salt, it's a homeopathic remedy. Those can all be helpful. And I'm just wondering if I should start doing a little calc fluor cell salts. Because, I'm sad every time I go, I have a little spot here, a little spot there. And it's because I'm an old lady. I'm drinking my coffee, I'm drinking my tea, and eating my fruit, and I'm getting some decay. So, maybe if I would do the calc fos or calc fluor cell salts, it would be helpful. Calc fluor cell salts, by the way, can be helpful for bone spurs. So if you have any bone spurs anywhere in your body, it can be helpful. And so when is the best time? Oh, yes. When you eat sugar, 10 to 15 minutes after you eat sugar, the pH of your mouth starts to drop. 30 to 60 minutes after eating, you have enough acid in your mouth to start causing damage. So if you're going to eat sugar, you might want to do something to get rid of bacteria, like do some xylitol, at least rinse your mouth with water, just good old water. He says that the best time to brush your teeth is actually before you eat because it prevents more plaque buildup. You're zeroing out the plaque. And you're like, well, why not after you eat? Because, aren't you going to have more plaque at that time? He doesn't think so. You're able to disrupt more plaque before you eat. He says that kids get cavities more often because they eat all the time. They're eating a lot, especially if they're eating a lot of starchy foods, like, you feed your kids crackers and goldfish and stuff like that. Those are like little plaque factories. They just, that starch is going to get in between your kids' teeth and it's going to make plaque and they're going to get cavities from that. He also said that a lot of people get gum recession because they brush too vigorously, that what you really want to do is brush gently in little circles at the surface, at the connection between your gums and your teeth. And you don't want to brush too vigorously and you want to spend 2 minutes brushing. He's not a believer in pH paper. That if you want to get an idea of the pH in your body, that when you use pH paper to test your overall pH, you're just testing the pH of your mouth, because and that can change with what has been in your mouth, with how hydrated you are, with what you ate. Mercury amalgams are problematic. They have mercury in them. So At best, they expand and contract because they have mercury in them, and mercury is a liquid at room temperature. Of course, mercury is in an amalgam form, but your mercury amalgams are at least half mercury. And then there's other metals in them. There's some aluminum. There's some there's some silver in them. There's a couple other metals. They do expand, but they expand and contract, which can be bad for your teeth and can make them crack. And so ultimately, I had one mercury amalgam in my mouth that was placed when I was 10 and no others. And I didn't get any more cavities until I was much older. And one day, a few years ago, I was at Dr. Shvarik's office, and she looked at the tooth and said, "All right, it's coming out." And it wasn't necessarily because, oh, you know, mercury amalgams are bad for you because they give off mercury gas and that's neurotoxic to you. It was because my tooth was starting to show signs of cracking. So she took the mercury amalgam out and she replaced it with composite. And then I continued to get cavities in the tooth. And finally, one day she said, "There's no place left for me to fix that tooth. I have to make you a crown." So the tooth, the one tooth I had with the amalgam in it, now has a crown on it. I don't have crowns anywhere else. All my other teeth, I have healthy roots. The tops of the teeth just get problematic. I'm trying to work on my enamel with a bunch of stuff. And that tooth, the one that had the amalgam in it. So Dr. Tom is not a fan of amalgams. He says that mercury is the most neurotoxic of the heavy metals. Even arsenic. You know how you worry about how there's arsenic in the soil? So when you eat, one of the things we learned was that mushrooms stimulate the production of a protella, which is a probiotic in your gut that really does. It's not easy to give in pill form because it's anaerobic, and so it's not really stable. So, but in order to encourage its growth, you can eat mushrooms. Well, one of the problems is that mushrooms bring up arsenic. So does rice. So do a number of other foods. They draw arsenic into them. And people are worried about, oh my goodness, I'm getting arsenic into my body. And it's a concern, but it's not as much of a concern as mercury. Arsenic is neurotoxic over a long period of time. And if you do things like eat lots of antioxidants and detoxify regularly, the arsenic is probably not going to bother you. But mercury is one of those things that you really just don't want to have in your body. And if you've got a lot of amalgam fillings, it's a concern. Should you get them out? What I usually tell my patients is that if they're stable, that you may not want to worry about them. Getting them out is a big deal. There is a lot of mercury vapor that's released when you get them removed, which is why if you've ever had a mercury filling removed, an amalgam filling removed, they cover you up. You wear special glasses. Your dentist suits up and looks like welders. And when I had that amalgam taken out, that's exactly what happened. I had a dental dam on, and they were covered up, you know, all the, they were wearing masks. They did it. It was really cool. They did it the right way. So if you can get your amalgams out, it's not a bad idea. Gold, when, you know, people used to get gold crowns, people don't like the way they look as much now, but not nearly as toxic. It's not toxic the way that mercury is. There's a kind of composite called Admira Fusion, and it's the cleanest one. Doesn't have any BPA or other dangerous chemicals in it. It's pretty inert. So we learned that. Also, Dr. Tom was not so tough on x-rays. X-rays are mostly digital, so the amount of radiation you get is much lower. You get a single exposure. And you can also take homeopathic x-ray if you're concerned about it. And so you need to see what's going on. There are cavities between teeth are hard to see if you don't have a 3D x-ray. He thinks that a 3D cone beam x-ray is important. There's decay, like if you're deciding whether to get a root canal, or if you have a lot of pain in a tooth that's you've only had a 2D x-ray on, you may want to find a dentist that has a 3D x-ray to get it assessed, because it can see things that a 2D x-ray cannot. So root canals, he thinks root canals, you can have the root canal if you really need one, and they only really need to be taken out if they've gone bad, if you have a lot of decay on them. and you don't want, you don't want tissue to be migrating from teeth. I didn't know that there's a thing called a periodontal ligament. I was telling Dr. Schwarek that today, that I didn't know there was a PDL. And she went, oh, the PDL is very important. And she tells me that when you grind your teeth, you disrupt the PDL. And she can tell that people's PDLs are disrupted, that they're grinding their teeth. And she tries to get people to stop doing that. And when you get a lot of dental procedures, they can affect the PDL. And the periodontal ligament is what holds your tooth in place. So if you floss and pick and keep those periodontal surfaces clear and keep the bacteria out of them, your periodontal ligament will be much healthier. So, and your periodontal ligament is there to keep your teeth in place. And like I said, if you're going to get a root canal removed, you want to have a 3D x-ray. So fluoride, let's talk about fluoride for a minute. So this is interesting. So this is a naturopathic physician who is also a dentist. He said that he's not that concerned about topical fluoride. Excessive fluoride he is concerned about. So if you're doing fluoride treatments, you know, where you sit in the office and they have you sit with fluoride on your teeth for a long time, he doesn't like that. But if you have a little topical fluoride in your toothpaste, he thinks it's not a big deal. That as long as you're brushing your teeth and then you're spitting it out, it's not a big deal. And he thinks that when people get too much fluoride, that's when it's a problem. And he doesn't agree with the practice of fluoridating water. And because then you get fluorosis. If you absorb too much fluoride, then fluoride will replace minerals in your teeth and you get discoloration of the teeth and the teeth are weaker. Fluorosis in your body in general is a problem. And when you get fluoride substituting for other halogenic materials like iodine, for example, then you can get thyroid problems. So fluoride is also, if you eat a lot of processed food, you get fluoride in your processed food. So if you're drinking water, like if you're getting a soda from a public water supply in the public water supply, so like you're getting a soda at the big, you know, super gas station, you know, you go get your gas and you go in and you get, you get a free soda with your Reese's, right? So if you drink that, the water that's in that soda may be coming from the public water supply and there could be fluoride in it. So if you're eating out a lot and you're getting fluoride in the water from the places you're eating, even if you're not getting it at home, you may be getting too much fluoride. So fluoride is more a problem in that it's in the water supply and it's in processed food via the public water supply. So if you're ingesting fluoride and then you're putting it on your teeth and you're getting a fluoride treatment, then you get too much fluoride and fluorosis does become a problem. But if you are eating organic food and you're not using fluoridated water and you're brushing your teeth with a toothpaste that has a little bit of fluoride on it, or you're using like MI paste, which is the calcium phosphate CPP paste that helps to remineralize your teeth and has a tiny bit of fluoride in it, and you're not swallowing it, that's not a big deal. So that was very interesting. That made me rest a little bit easier in that, because you can get natural toothpaste that have fluoride in it. Now, if you disagree with me, I'd be happy to have a discussion with you about it. It is also true that calcium phosphate is really important for mineralizing teeth, and I just don't know if there are good studies on the use of calcium phosphate versus calcium phosphate with fluoride. What Dr. Schwarek tells me is that when she gives the CPPMI paste, especially in older people, she prefers to use the calcium phosphate paste that includes fluoride. She thinks it works better. And there are scientific studies that show that that's true. If you're really uncomfortable with using fluoride, you probably can, because let's go back to the Weston Price people, the people who were, the people who were in, eating a paleo diet and were eating their indigenous diets and had perfect teeth without brushing their teeth. So if you don't want to use fluoride, then it's a good idea. You have to watch your starch and sugar, or at least clear your mouth every time you eat starch and sugar. You want to be rinsing. And you perhaps want to consume some xylitol. By the way, Dr. Tom is not a fan of xylitol, which I found interesting. He thinks if it's toxic to dogs, it's probably toxic to us as well. I'm not sure I'm into that, because xylitol is such a wonderful, biofilm disruptor. So it does destroy plaque. And, you know, if you eat, you know, it's not well absorbed. I mean, some of it is absorbed, but it's not well absorbed. It does give some people gas and bloating. And if that's you, then you don't want to consume it. And for most people, it'll start to give you gas if you have over 40 grams a day. So I tend to use it as candy, and it's in my toothpaste, and I don't have too much in a day. But if I have a little piece, I'm going to get maybe a gram or two of xylitol in a piece of candy that I'm going to eat after I have my sweet. And that's going to inhibit the biofilm made by the bacteria that's going to ultimately grow. So if you have a couple of pieces of xylitol candy through the day when you're not in a place where you can brush your teeth, I think that can be helpful. Also, you can get high xylitol toothpaste, especially if it's fluoride free, and just throw it in your mouth and just spread it around. You don't necessarily have to brush your teeth. Like, I keep some in my drawer and I'll throw it in my mouth and swirl it around. It tastes very sweet, but it'll kill the microbes that I had have introduced by my, 230 piece of chocolate. So, anyway, the other thing is that abscesses, 3D x-rays can show the abscess. He's a big fan of the 3D x-ray because you can see more stuff. That was interesting to me that this was a naturopathic physician who was saying that a little bit of topical fluoride is not a big deal. Fluoridation coming from water supplies, both that you're drinking as well as when you go to restaurants and also when you buy processed food. There can be fluoride in those foods because their fluoridated water was used to produce those foods. So it was very interesting. So those were some of the things I learned. I actually have more things that I can talk about, but I'm just about out of time. Let me see if I have any other things that I'll give you some teasers. Let's see. So DHEA can be really helpful. If you're a person who's taking thyroid medication, and your thyroid numbers are good, but you're still tired, it might be a good idea to treat the adrenals, which is something I've done anyway, but he affirmed that. Laughter is really good for you. You make oxytocin when you laugh a lot, which is the bonding hormone. It reduces stress. It reduces stress as hormones. DHEA can be really helpful if you're tired and your DHEA is low. He has a procedure by which he offers people DHEA. He thinks if you get insomnia when you're taking DHEA, you're too stressed and you have to work on the stress. And there's other ways to do that, which we will talk about. Low-dose naltrexone is good for a lot of stuff, including reducing inflammation in a bunch of ways. If you're interested in a probiotic that helps you lose weight, the species Lactobacillus geseri seems to be one that can be helpful. And we'll go through this at another time. Also, eating more walnuts seem to promote weight loss. So if you want to add a food to your diet that promotes weight loss, walnuts is one of them. So is avocados. And I was very happy because I went to the Not Only Juice today, and they had avocado chocolate pudding. So I'm going to eat that. It's going to be good. All right. I think that's all the things I could talk about today. All right. So you have, I have more updates to give you. I may talk about more stuff that I learned at the NHAN conference because there's so many great things to talk about. So it was very exciting to go to the New Hampshire Association of Naturopathic Doctors Conference. I always go. It's a lot of fun. Big shout out to Tina Bodoin. I hope I said that right. And Ruth Galbraith and Lori, whose last name I can't remember, for putting on a great conference and from all the great speakers. And it was really great to see you folks. And I hope to see you next year. Not sure if it will be in North Conway again. It could be in Nashua. It could be in Portsmouth. And that will be the first time that it's in Portsmouth. And if it is, I will be very happy because I will be very thrilled to go someplace that's near the ocean. All right. So if I don't have to go to jury duty, I'll be here next week. Otherwise, I'll see you in 2 weeks. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the call and talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza was away this week. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments on my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Storrs.